From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's a long story that we'll get to later, but at some point, the scholar Rachel Maines stumbled upon the subject of the history of the vibrator. And early on, she noticed just how uncomfortable people were with it. The reaction of men, she said, was divided into laughter and blank stares. And at some point, she realized that all of this information about the tools used to produce a female orgasm was making them feel resentful. She says they would really take it personally. And why? Well, Maine's research is about how we perceive female sexuality, and throughout history, we just haven't gotten it right. There's a movie coming out and a play now running inspired by Rachel Maine's work. It's giving us an opportunity to talk about the history of the vibrator. More broadly, it's about our attitudes, ancient and modern, about sex and pleasure. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The scholar Rachel Maines says she didn't find the subject of the history of the vibrator. The subject, she says, found her. For years, she dug into the history of it all, and early on, she noticed just how polarizing it could be. She says she discovered that some people, and most of them were men, took her research personally. She says they resented it like it was some kind of implied criticism. Some men laugh, some men just have these blank stares, and in her book, she writes, the former are those for whom my research confirms that women are as sexual as they had hoped. The latter are those for whom it confirms that women are as sexual as they had always feared. Her research is about how we perceive female sexuality and pleasure, and throughout history we just haven't understood it very well. There's a movie coming out and a play now running inspired by Rachel Maine's work. It's giving us an opportunity to talk about the history of the vibrator, more broadly our attitudes, ancient and modern, about sexual pleasure. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Rachel Maines is an historian who focuses on technology. She's a visiting scientist in the Cornell University School of Electrical and Computer Engineering and is joining us today by phone from her home in Ithaca, New York. Her book is called The Technology of Orgasm, Hysteria, The Vibrator and Women's Sexual Satisfaction. It's the basis, as we mentioned, for a Pulitzer Prize-nominated play and a Hollywood movie, and we'll give you the details about those as we go along. Rachel Maines, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I wanted to start with your research is really interesting because you've looked at some really interesting kinds of subjects, and you write about in your book how you've always been kind of fascinated or drawn to, I don't know how to put it, kind of obscure topics. Is that about right?
Yes, that's right. That's a good way of putting it.
Why?
Things that nobody else was working on.
Stuff that no one else was working on. Why do you figure you were drawn to that? Just because it was that no one else was working on it? Was that part of the appeal?
Definitely. Born to be a troublemaker. My mother's kind of a troublemaker, too, so I come by it honestly.
So how did you, as I mentioned in the introduction there, the subject came to you more than you coming to it. Take us through how you found it, because it's an interesting story.
It is. It's one of those stories that's kind of counterintuitive. The subject I was actually working on, and that I had been working on since the early 70s, was the history of American needlework. I am what is now called a veteran feminist, which kind of makes me feel old, but I guess, you know, if you're 61, you better start feeling your age.
Right.
But anyway, I was interested in needlework as something that women did, and I was particularly interested in the period between 1880 and 1930 in the United States. And there's no bibliographic access to that material. It's not like there's some, you know, great big index that you can consult. And, of course, nothing was online when I was doing this. So I just went and found great big piles of these needlework magazines in places like the New York Public Library and the Library of Congress, and went, you know, and just went through them page by page. And what struck me is there were all these ads for vibrators. Hmm. And I thought, what? You know, it's way early for any electrical device in the first place. I knew this because I was, you know, I'm an historian of technology. I know a little bit about the electrical history of the United States. And, like, 1905 is very early for an electrical appliance in the home.
Yeah.
Well, what I found out eventually is that the vibrator is only the fifth electrical appliance to be introduced into the home.
Wow.
Yeah, it's contemporaneous with the toaster.
Wow. So,
woman does not live by toast alone.
That's right. So you were looking at all of this. So what were they? I mean, were they very explicit? What did they say on them? Did they have? I guess they had pictures and things.
Oh, they had pictures, yes, but they were very discreet.
Yeah.
In fact, in my book, I talk about this as social camouflage. That if you knew what you were looking for, then you knew what the ads were telling you. But if you didn't, then you wouldn't. The women would have the vibratodes, as they were then called, the attachments up against like the small of their back or against their forehead, or sometimes somewhat daringly against their chests. And the text would tell you this was good for your circulation, good for your health.
Yeah.
But then they would say things like thrilling, penetrating, invigorating, all the pleasures of youth will throb within you. And if you knew, you know, what you were reading, you'd say, hey, that sounds like it's for me. But if you didn't, you'd say, oh, gee, that sounds pretty good. You know? There was a lot of camouflage. The vibrator was not advertised as a frankly sexual device until, more than a half a century later.
Wow. So what was the implication there? I mean, people got it, right? They just didn't. There was a sort of a wink about what these things were for.
That's about what it was,
yeah.
Yes. And they were sometimes shown in use by men, but they also were advertised as gifts that men could give women. Mm-hmm. Like there was one that appeared in Hearst magazine about 1915 for the Star Vibrator, which was about $5 then, which was not cheap, but not, you know, completely out of reach of the middle class.
Yeah.
And it said, such delightful companions, this woman is sitting there with her electrical appliances. And the vibrator, this is addressed to the men who might be buying it for her, a gift that will keep her young and pretty. Her eyes will sparkle, her cheeks will be pink. I'll bet they were, too. You know? Hi, honey, I've had a nice day at home today.
But it's interesting, though, that... So I guess you were pretty kind of bemused by it all. But, I mean, you really, this wasn't a novelty project for you. I mean, you saw something kind of deeply reflective about society in here. At what point did that strike you?
Well, the first thing I was trying to focus on this needlework thing that I was writing.
Yeah.
And I kept seeing these ads, and I thought, I'm going to ignore these because if I write about this, it will completely wreck my career. Because nobody will ever take me seriously again,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I was about, since I was about 27, 28 years old, you know, I figured, well, you know, I don't even have, like, an advanced degree. Now, a few years later, I went back to school at Carnegie Mellon University of Pittsburgh and got an advanced degree. And I had made notes of where I had seen these ads, and I kept thinking about them and thinking about them. And every time I would see something else that would remind me, like one of the textbooks we had at Carnegie Mellon was a book by a fellow named Gideon called Mechanization Takes Command. And there's an illustration in there of a woman who is receiving the water cure by what the French called the douche method. And it's this jet of pumped water directed at her pelvis. And I thought, now, that looks like another one of these socially camouflaged technologies. And after I got my doctorate, I said, you know, I don't think I can resist this anymore. I think I'm just going to go ahead and write something about it. So I did, and the first thing that happened, there was a big upscut about it, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's see if I can remember what IEEE stands for, Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers,
yeah.
Which had a historical publication, still does. And they had a historical issue about electrical technology, and I said, oh, that's perfect. So I sent them an article about this, and the organization that sponsored the journal, that is the IEEE, threatened to put them right out of business, to withdraw their charter.
Yeah.
It was really quite funny, actually.
Wait, when was this? About when? This was in the late 70s,
1989.
80s? Yeah. Wow, 1989, which is interesting,
yeah.
Because... I mean, you get a sense that, you know, that academics or whomever else could be prudish, you know, in another time. But people still feel uneasy about all of this, it seems.
Oh, yes, that's true. In fact, I heard, or actually, I think I may have read this in the Wall Street Journal review of Sarah Rule's play.
Yeah.
We saw it in New York City, and we're very impressed. It's very funny and well worth seeing. But I heard that there was a woman and her husband sitting before in front of the reviewer, and at the end of the first act, the husband got up and said, "This is a play for women. I'll be in the bar across the street when you're done here."
Mm-hmm.
So some people are still not comfortable with the whole idea of all this.
You also write in your book, which seems to get kind of to get at this fundamental impression that we have had or still have maybe in some ways of the female orgasm. There was a presentation you mentioned at a particular university, and there's this senior professor, a tenured fellow, I suppose, and he said to you that he wasn't convinced by your arguments because he figured the sexual experience of women using vibrators wasn't, and here's his term, the real thing.
Yes, that guy was even wearing a Harris tweed jacket with the suede elbow patches. He was really in uniform. And that was quite a small audience. There can't have been more than about 10 people there. And for some reason that I didn't really quite understand, all the men sat on one side of the table and all the women sat on the other side. And because this is a very traditional university with a very traditional faculty, and this was in the 1980s, the women were all either graduate students or junior faculty. And one of the graduate students, I was trying to think of some way to break the bad news to this poor guy, one of the graduate students said, "But don't you see, Dr. So-and-so? Most of the time, it's better than the real thing." And he got this look of horror on his face and kind of sank back in his seat and didn't say another word for the rest of the seminar. You can see how that would be kind of threatening if men are brought up to believe that that intercourse is supposed to be the thing that really, you know, rings women's chimes.
Yeah.
And when it turns out that really a minority of us reach orgasm that way, it's not very good news for guys. And if they've been brought up to think that they should be able to do this and they can't, then it makes everybody feel bad, makes the women feel bad, makes the men feel bad. So I thought, you know, it's time we really talked about this and were honest with each other, you know, about it and said, "Hey, let's have fun together in whatever way we can, and it doesn't have to always be the same way."
It's interesting how far back all of this goes. This idea you mentioned in your book from the 4th century BC until the American Psychiatric Association dropped the term. There was a condition known as hysteria.
That's right.
So explain what it is, what it was, what they saw as hysteria.
Well, the word means womb disease. Huster is the Greek word for uterus. And the idea was, and you'll find this in Plato's Timaeus. So it's got quite a distinguished pedigree, this term. Plato described the uterus as an animal within an animal. And he was under the, he labored under the misapprehension that the uterus could move around inside the body, that it could, like, you know, crawl up into her windpipe and choke her, and it crawled out into her arm and caused pain, because it was a mobile organ and it really belonged in the pelvis. The way to lure it back to where it belonged was massage of the external genitalia.
Yeah.
Now Plato doesn't tell you about the external genitalia, but that's in Hippocrates, and turns up again in Galen, Soranus,
wow.
Aretius Capodox, who's 1st century AD, and then a whole bunch of doctors all the way through to the end of the 19th century, that you treated hysteria. The hysteria was the revolt of the uterus against neglect. And in order to get it to behave itself again and to stop bothering the woman that it lived in, you had to give it some attention. And you'd use fragrant oil and massage. Sometimes you would do the massage, a midwife would be called in to do the massage so that the doctor wouldn't have to, as it were, get his hands dirty. And also the doctors complained bitterly about how difficult it was to learn how long it took. It took some of them up to an hour to produce the, quote, hysterical paroxysm, unquote.
Yeah, which was a female orgasm.
Well, that's what it looks like to me. They were very careful to call it, you know, something medical.
Right, but see, this is the thing that's interesting. I mean, neglect. But didn't it occur to them, I guess this gets at our impressions of female sexuality. Didn't it occur to them that that sex, but proper sex, more creative sex, could have solved all of this? That it wasn't a medical thing. That it could be handled through, you know, a more creative relationship with your partner.
Well, they didn't think about it that way.
Yeah.
There was a saying in ancient Greece, a goat for satisfaction, a woman for business, and a boy for pleasure. And they really didn't think a whole lot about women's sexuality as being something that needed any attention on its own. They were interested in not in creative sex, but in sex that created. And of course, if you're trying to produce conception, then coitus is the best way to go.
Right.
There were, you know, there is this minority of women who do reach orgasm in coitus. And in fact, physicians routinely prescribe marriage for single women who were, quote, hysterical, unquote. And usually they would send the woman home and say, if she was married, go home and have sex with your husband. That'll make you feel better.
Right.
But sometimes the women, in fact, my guess is more often than not, the women came back and said, yeah, okay, you know, I had sex with my husband. I still have this vague feeling of heaviness in my abdomen, and I'm sleepless, and I'm restless, and I feel I have all these fantasies, and, you know, which is, by the way, that was a symptom. That and lubrication,
wow.
Vaginal lubrication. These were symptoms of hysteria. So they would come back to the doctor. The doctor would say, well, okay, I guess you need, you know, massage therapy. So that's, you know, they knew that there was some sexual connection.
Yeah.
But they didn't, as you say, having a more creative relationship was not something that most of them thought about.
You're right.
It must have been some, but you don't find much in the literature.
Yeah. You're right about a particular treatment from the late 17th century. And the idea was to have this midwife assist.
Right.
And the treatment, which was general massage, basically, is what the treatment was. And the treatment says that it's recommended for widows and those who live chaste lives, but not so much for very young women, public women, and married women.
Right. Because they were supposed to go home and have sex with some guy. The unmarried women, the very young women, they would recommend marriage. And actually, they sometimes also recommended horseback riding.
Wow.
And some women, you know, can have an orgasm riding a horse. you have to be configured in just the right way, and I don't know exactly how that is. I'm not one of them. But that was another one of the treatments that were prescribed. The water cure was another one, including that douche therapy I told you about earlier.
And all this stems from just this, basically a central misunderstanding of female sexuality, that it works differently for women than it does for men. Basically, we didn't understand that for thousands of years.
Yes, and it seems like something that should have occurred to somebody, but a lot of things are like that. You know, it seems as if the Romans should have invented the wheelbarrow, but they didn't. They would have loved the wheelbarrow, but it was another 1,000 years before wheelbarrows were invented.
And the reason why it didn't occur to someone, you figure, was it because this was also much bound up in social mores and because it was about sex? I mean, is that what took so long for it to occur to people?
Well, you know, historically, having an erect penis has been extremely important to men, and not just in the sense of their self-esteem. In antiquity, for example, gods always had these very, you know, like large and prominent penises, and they were often erect. They're in the hirms of Athens. So this is partly religious as well, that the erect penis is a religious symbol in antiquity, and it's a symbol of fertility. So I think there's a pronatalism that is involved here, that because having a lot of children, being able to produce an erection, impregnate a bunch of women, this is all very important for not just individual men, but for the male place in society. including inheritance, wealth, and so on. I think it would have been very hard to integrate with that a concept of women's sexuality where she decides what man she wants on the basis of how good he is at sex as a human being, not just as, you know, a guy with an erection.
Rachel Maines is with us. She's a technology historian and the author of The Technology of Orgasm Hysteria, The Vibrator and Women's Sexual Satisfaction. We should mention Pygmalion Theater Company is staging the play In the Next Room, or The Vibrator Play. It runs through May 19th at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. The film Hysteria, starring Maggie Gyllenhaal, opens May 18th in New York and Los Angeles. It's going to be coming to Salt Lake, for those of you here in Utah, at the Broadway Center Cinemas next month. For details about all of that, you can go to our website at KUER.org/Radio West. We invite you to join the conversation. You can call 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the fascinating history of the vibrator. There's a film opening in the U.S. this month, a play here in Salt Lake City that explores the history of female sexuality, the development of this technology to cure what they used to call hysteria. Vibrators were seen as a medical treatment for women who weren't getting much pleasure out of sex and were discouraged from working out the problem themselves, if you know what I mean. This is about the way we've defined a woman's role in society and about our still backwards ideas about sex. There's a play, as I mentioned, the play in Salt Lake City. We're going to get to that here in just a moment. Rachel Maines is joining us now, an historian who focuses on technology. She's the author of the book, The Technology of Orgasm, Hysteria, The Vibrator, and Women's Sexual Satisfaction. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. So, Rachel Maines, your focus really comes around to the vibrator itself, obviously because you're interested in technology. So, how did the vibrator sort of evolve? At what point did we start thinking we can come up with a tool to do this? There's a more efficient way to handle hysteria.
Well, the water cure stuff began pretty early. The Romans had pumped hot water, but we don't know whether they used it for that purpose or not. Bath got in England got a kind of a seedy reputation for dissipation, but again, it's a little unclear what kind of dissipation they mean. We know the men went off and gambled, and the women were at the baths, but what exactly happened, we're not too sure. It becomes much less ambiguous in the 19th century when water cures begin to use this therapy that I told you about earlier, douche therapy. Mm. But then I think the first step in the direction of a true vibrator at the end of the 18th century was a device called the percutor, which was a clockwork device. You wound it up. But, of course, you know, when you wind something up, it winds down. And, you know, you had to keep winding it back up again. It was kind of an awkward thing. So a guy named George Taylor, an American, invented a steam-powered, coal-fired vibrator called the Manipulator that was available in 1869.
Wow.
But, you know, coal-fired, you know, the doctors didn't like having to shovel coal into it. Steam engines are really cranky things anyway, and this wasn't the most efficient way to do it either. So finally, in the 1880s, a British a physician named Joseph Mortimer Granville, who I believe is the chief protagonist in the film, Tanya Wexler's film Hysteria that's coming out. He invented the electromechanical vibrator as we know it, and the first ones were manufactured by Weiss, which is actually a perfectly respectable medical instrument company that still exists.
You know, there's that question that comes up whether or not there's any evidence of that this was just a bunch of men who were trying to take advantage of their position, you know, get their willies, basically massaging women. You say it didn't really work out that way, at least not for most, that this was, as you say, a job that nobody else wanted.
Yeah, exactly. And the men didn't, the doctors really didn't like it very much. They were not, they wanted to get it done as fast as possible. In fact, there's a guy named Alfred Covey who wrote a book called, in 1909, called Profitable Office Specialties. And he's got a whole chapter on vibrotherapy in which he tells you that, well, you know, what used to take an hour, you could get it done in 5 minutes. And, of course, what he's talking about is the cash flow situation, but also you don't need a lot of skill, he tells you. It doesn't take, you know, years to learn how to do it right. And at the rate of you know, 1 hour, that's not a very good rate of productivity if you're a doctor. So it was really, it was a business decision, and it was the doctors. There was a brief period in British history where it was controversial. And where some people thought it was really shocking that male doctors were doing this. But the doctor's response was, well, she's sick. She needs our help. It's just something that it's a service that we provide because our patients are sick and they need us to do this for them. And of course, you know, there was a lot of camouflage about it. It wasn't really sexual. But the doctors really felt that it was a chore that had to be done.
Mm. You see, it was a huge market. I mean, if you were good at it, seems like you could make some decent money, I guess.
Yes. Well, that was what Alfred Covey was all about, you know, profitable office specialties.
Yeah.
And he's got pictures of vibrators, you know, like, and he tells you in the text that you should buy a vibrator that looks imposing. Because otherwise people will think that it's just one of those little handheld models like they can get at Sears. But you want yours to look like a physician's instrument. So it's got like mother of pearl dials and,
wow,
you know, the really big ones like the Chattanooga vibrator, which appears in the play, which is about 5 feet tall,
yeah,
and weighs 175 pounds. Those were very popular among doctors.
So how did they perceive women who had this so-called condition? Were they perceived as victims? Because you say in your book, it seems like many, if not most of them, must have known what was actually going on.
Yeah. Well, the doctors felt sorry for them and felt that they, you know, they were performing a valuable service. We don't know what the women thought because at least I have not found any sources by women from the historical period we're talking about. I'm hoping that younger generations of scholars will keep going and maybe they'll find something, but it's very difficult. You know, even now, you don't find very many first-person accounts of sexuality. You find erotic literature sometimes, mm-hmm, but a lot of it's fictional. And we have the doctor's accounts, but we really don't know what was even going through their minds, although a lot of them seem like John Harvey Kellogg, the cornflakes guy.
Yeah.
He used to do vibratory therapy, and he writes about it in like, gee, why they don't seem to feel any pain at all while we're doing this, you know? And I'm like, yeah, you're right, John. but he doesn't seem to have any sense of it being sexual.
Hmm.
But I'm sure some doctors did know,
yeah,
what was going on.
Yeah. Let me get another voice involved in the conversation. Fran Prine is joining us here in the studio. She's the artistic director of Pygmalion Theater Company, the director of their production of In the Next Room, or the Vibrator Play, which is based, of course, on the writing of Rachel Maines. And Fran Prine, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, I guess let's start with, when did you strike upon this play? When did you first hear about it and figure you wanted to stage it?
Well, it had a wonderful New York run, yeah, and of course was recognized by the Pulitzer Committee. It was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, so it had a lot of notoriety in the theater community. I read it. I think it was first produced in 2009. Yeah. Dr. Maines probably can ascertain that. And then I read it and said, oh, you know, not only is the show wonderfully funny and wonderfully poignant, it also serves our mission statement perfectly, and our Pygmalion Productions gives voice to women and their life experiences, and I couldn't think of a show that actually fit the bill better.
Yeah. How are people reacting? It's interesting because Rachel Maines writes in her book about the fact that Remind me, Rachel Maines, women either laugh. If there's a mixed company, they just laugh and ask. No, if it's just women, they laugh and ask questions. If it's mixed company, they laugh a little bit, and it's a different kind of reaction.
Yeah, they're trying to mind their manners.
Right.
But because they know that the guys are like, whoa, what's all this about, you know? Yeah, so I'd be very curious to know about play in that context.
How are people reacting?
Well, it's interesting. We have a predominantly female audience because I think, first and foremost, I think women go to plays. I think that you can look at our audience demographics, and I don't think they're that much different that many theater companies' audience demographics, perhaps skewed a little more to the women because of our mission statement. But 70% of our audiences are women, or the men that they've drug, or the men, or the theater people that the theater people that will go to anything. That said, Sarah Rule has written a marvelously funny but marvelously poignant show, and it's not exclusively funny. The funny stuff is all about the vibrator itself and the misconceptions about women's sexuality, women's own misconceptions about their sexuality, and that is in fact hilarious. And that discovery, I mean, some of these women are having orgasms for the first times in their lives,
and not knowing what to make of it.
No, they didn't think it was necessarily a good thing, but they were becoming addicted to them.
That's really quite historically accurate.
Is it? They don't know what to make of it. This is now they've experienced pleasure for the first time, and I guess there's a little guilt there at first, maybe, or confusion. Do you think, Rachel Maines? Do we know? Do they talk about it?
Well, George Taylor, the inventor of the steam powered vibrator, tells the doctors who might buy his machine that women will report feelings that they've never had before, and they won't know what to make of them. He doesn't say what they are, those feelings. He just says they won't know. You know, and so you should reassure them that these pleasurable feelings signal the return of health.
Well, it's no wonder they didn't think it was sexual. If they had never actually experienced an orgasm during a sexual act, these paroxysms, nor had the men that they were with, that they were partnered with. So they all thought this was a different experience. And the humor in the play really is our 20th century view of what these misconceptions are. However, there's also great poignancy in the play in looking at how trapped these women were in their societal positions, and how, as well as the men, you know, they have very, very clear and rigid conformity and what those expectations are. And the beautiful, beautiful last moments of this show when the husband and wife come together and want to make each other happy some way or another is really, really both compelling and heartbreaking.
Yeah. Set it up for us, if you would, Frank. Give us the basic sort of plot structure for the play. I mean, this takes place in the house mostly of Dr. Givens.
Yes, this is circa 1880s. Dr. Givens is, I guess, a gynecologist. If they had, I don't know, Dr. Maines, did they have such a specialty then?
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
And he largely treated women for hysteria. Sarah Rule has written that his wife, his office is in his home, as was commonly the practice, is operating theater.
Right.
And he and his wife, his somewhat younger wife, have just had a baby. And the baby is robust. However, she is unable to provide enough milk to sustain the baby. So as the patients parade through the house, she becomes more and more and more intrigued by them and what's going on in the next room, because she's utterly confused what he's doing next there, and that these people will go in upset and come out, well, blissful
and sleepy
and wonderful. At the same time, she's attracted to their stories, and she creates a relationship with the wet nurse that one of the husbands of a patient finds for her, and that through that wet nurse she understands, well, this is something that it actually could happen, having relations with my husband.
Yeah, it all, and this awareness sort of unfolds throughout the play. There's a scene I wanted to ask you about. It's this umbrella scene, which seems to reflect an important theme, Fran Prine, in that this is really about the way, and this is Mrs. Givings. She's not quite sure to where she fits in.
Yes, Mrs. Givings is speaking with Mr. Daldry, and Mr. Daldry is perhaps the archetypical man of the period. He's really in the play, from my point of view, to establish men's roles and what those expectations are. But he's waiting for his wife, who's being treated in the next room. And Mrs. Givings has struck up a conversation with how they're supposed to go out and walk in the rain. And she says, well, do you carry an umbrella when it's raining or not? Because I think it's horribly romantic when people don't carry umbrellas. And he says he does. And then asks what type of person she was. And she says, well, I don't know. I don't know what type of person I am. My husband has always carried the umbrella. He makes that decision. There are additional references. She doesn't have any access to money when Elizabeth needs to be paid. She says at one point, well, I'm not a good mother. I'm nothing at all because I can't provide milk. What do? I pour the tea.
Yeah.
It's a...
So the idea that her life is confined to a very particular role.
Absolutely. She is a wife and she is a mother, and they're clearly somewhat affluent. They're in New York, in a spa town in New York in circa 1880s, after the Civil War. And there's the expectation that she will procreate and she will be a good mother and it will be all good. But she actually has a revolutionary husband. She has an abolitionist, doctor, revolutionary husband who just wants the best thing for her and just wants the best thing for the baby. It's a fascinating thing as you see him evolve as well at the end of the show and realize that perhaps she can be satisfied in something other than a role as a mother.
This idea of roles, Rachel Maines, that seems an important theme for the when you were looking at the story itself, that how we put women throughout history into certain sort of set figured roles.
Oh, yes, that's right. And in fact, it used to be just within my lifetime, the ideas of Freud about that, you know, women were not really grown ups unless they had vaginal orgasms. That was it was in the 1960s that people finally said, well, maybe this is a ridiculous distinction. You know, and that maybe what Freud had in mind is impossible for most women. So that was, you know, there was this idea that in order, you know, women were supposed to be good mothers, they were supposed to be good wives, they were supposed to be passive, they were supposed to be ladylike. And that put, you know, a lot of, puts a crimp in just about everything, not just sexuality, but, you know, I'm a scholar and I stared out my papers sometimes. You know, I shall argue that, you know, da 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 da,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Well, it's not ladylike to argue. So, you know, in a lot of areas, all of that, that, you know, having to be passive and not asserting yourself, you know, there's a documentary film of which I am going to shamelessly plug.
Go for it.
of my book called Passion and Power. It's by Wendy Slick and Emiko Omori. And I'll have you know they took a second mortgage on their houses in order to finish the film. It's a wonderful film. And in it, they interview Betty Dodson, who's one of the pioneers of the vibrator as a feminist icon. And Betty believes, and I think she has a point, that when women are in touch with their sexuality and know how it works, that they are just stronger human beings generally, and that they are more successful with their partners, whether their partners are men or women.
Rachel Maines is with us. She's the author of the book, The Technology of Orgasm Hysteria, The Vibrator and Women's Sexual Satisfaction. Fran Prine is here with us in the studio, the director of Pygmalion Theater Company's production of In the Next Room, or The Vibrator Play, which is based on Rachel Maine's research. The play runs through May 19th at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. For tickets, you can call ArtTix at 801-355-ARTS for more information. We should also mention the film Hysteria, starring Maggie Gyllenhaal, opens May 18th in New York and L.A. The Broadway Center Cinemas here in Salt Lake City is screening it next month. For details on information in your area and to find out about the ticket information, go to our website, KUER.org/Radio West. We need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with scholar Rachel Maines and director Fran Prine. We're talking about the history of the vibrator. There's a film opening in the U.S. this month, a play here in Salt Lake City that explores the history of female sexuality and the development of this technology. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. We'll give you details about the play and the film a little bit later here in the program. Well, Fran Prine, talk to us about another character, which introduces another kind of element to this story, which is how these treatments were sometimes developed and used for men. There's a character named Leo in the play.
Yes, it was rare, mind you, at least according to Dr. Givings. But he says at one point, well, we rarely see hysteria in men, but then, of course, Leo is an artist.
Yeah. That always gets a laugh.
Yeah, I bet.
And he's living his life outside the usual social norms. He's an artist. He's a painter. He's been living in Italy. And he's been abandoned by the woman he brought home to meet his parents because she was probably terrified by the society that he was from. And he can't paint. He can't express himself in any way. He can't see. He can't paint. He feels weakness in his extremities. So they use the vibrator on him. I believe it's the Chattanooga vibrator on him to produce, as Dr. Givings called it, an anal paroxysm, which immediately cures him.
It's immediately. Yeah, yeah.
But what's wonderful about the character is he really does say, let loose your corsets and breathe, Mrs. Givings. Look outside the boundaries of the society you're looking in. And Mrs. Givings talks to him about, you're the first man who's ever, or first person who's ever talked to me about sunsets and prostitutes and souls hovering outside their eyes. So it was just he experiences women in this tremendously ridiculous romantic way, but he does awaken such life in her and the possibilities that she's never known outside her her doors.
Rachel Maines, talk about how this. I guess it was rare, but these kinds of treatments were used on men.
Yes, in fact, I burst out laughing as soon as they put what's the character's name again? The artist?
Leo.
Leo. They put Leo on the table because I thought, oh my, here we go. This is from the Chattanooga Treatment Manual. In my book, I have a picture of a guy receiving this very treatment with the Chattanooga vibrator, and it's in the instruction manual for the Chattanooga that was designed to give doctors, you know, ideas about how to use it. Now, the guy's got his back to you, so you can't, you know, you can't tell anything about him. But it was very powerful and fascinating to me to see this come to life on the stage in the way that it did. But, yes, the vibratory treatment was used on men, and vibration of the prostate was supposed to be good for some kinds of male disorders. I don't think the instruction book tells you which ones, but hysteria, it was controversial whether men could be hysterical, but some doctors said they were and treated them as hysterics.
Yeah, because I don't That I don't understand. I mean, if we thought about them differently, you know, in terms of their sexual – men having sexual pleasure, at what point would you get to hysteria, you know?
Well, Freud thought that hysteria was caused by lesions in consciousness. And so by his definition, men could be hysterical.
Yeah.
And he had that in place, by that theory, by about 1890. So some doctors were simply following Freud and thinking that. Basically, Freud redefined hysteria. He said, okay, it's not a womb disease. It doesn't have anything to do with sex. So by the time that they got to talking about men being hysterical, that Freud was already an influence.
I want to, Fran Prine, I want to ask you about Elizabeth, which is a really powerful character in the film. As you mentioned, she's this this black wet nurse, basically, that works for Mrs. Givings. She's lost her own child, of course, and she's kind of having this crisis of faith.
She is. She's absolutely the moral center of the show. And in the research I've done, I've learned that African Americans were, in fact, released from slavery in New York in the early 19th century, in the 1820s. So she was, in fact, a free woman. However, this the show really speaks to the class differences and the class issues that existed between the races at this point in time. So she is the maid of a couple of the other characters in the show, and she's recently lost her own baby. She has two children of her own, and she prays to God, to release her from the suffering, but she also prays to God to save her son, and it doesn't work, and so she loses her faith. It's she is aloof, she is dignified, she is simple, she has great morality or a great sense of morality. But when you see the suffering at the core of this this wonderfully self-possessed woman, you also understand that this human condition, this bonding with children, is just not something as simple as milk or simply as procreation.
It's interesting too, she is she doesn't seem as bound up by the conventions of this Victorian society as the others.
She doesn't. And you wonder how much of that was Sarah Rules just trying to make a point.
Sure.
And how much of it is that, Victorians really, really had very, very rigid rules. I mean, they slept in different rooms. The men, the husbands came to their wives and in darkened rooms and were very polite and courteous. They expected their women, at least one census from the show, they expected their women not to be enjoying this, but really to be providing a service for them. This was not something that was necessarily something that was a wifely pleasure. No, that was needlepoint and playing pianos.
Right. There's a moment in the play which seems to kind of represent an important issue. And Mrs. Givings and Mrs. Daldry, they break into to the operating room where Dr. Givings administers the treatments. And the question comes up whether the doctor is the only person who can administer this treatment.
Yes, and Mrs. Givings says, well, I don't understand why not. Women can push a button now too.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a tremendously liberating moment with the women exploring the vibrator, each other and with each other.
And Rachel Maines, to talk about that, at what point did we put this medical procedure into the actual hands of women finally?
Well, it was more like women grabbed it for themselves.
Right.
The history of it is that doctors really wanted to keep control of the vibrator as a medical instrument. But by 1898, there were vibrators that were available. You could order them by mail. They were pretty clunky ones. But by 1905, they looked very much like modern vibrators, with two exceptions. One of them was, of course, they didn't have any plastic in them, some of them had Bakelite in them, which, as you probably know, is a very heavy material.
Yeah.
But they were made of metal, mostly. And the other thing that was different about them is that they had, because there was no conventional line electricity except for electric lighting at this period, They had what was called an Edison plug on one end. Instead of having two prongs, it looked like the base of a light bulb. So if you wanted to use your vibrator, you had to unscrew the light bulb. So I just figure you knew where everything was located, right? Because you'd be in the dark.
Yeah. Let me ask you this finally, both of you, quickly. We only have about a minute left. But, you know, this book's been out for more than a decade, Rachel Maines. The play written in 2009, the film just coming out now. Why do you figure there's such an interest now?
Oh, I think there's always been an interest.
This book has a life of its own. It's like some kind of giant global Rorschach test that I didn't know I was administering. But it just somehow, you know, over the last 10 years, it's gotten more and more people have been interested in it. It's been a puppet rock musical. It's been a Law and Order Special Victims Unit episode. It's been, well, as we know, a play, and now a Hollywood movie, a documentary film. It's come out in French, Italian, Spanish, and Japanese, and heaven only knows what next.
Yeah. And Fran, you say this finally. We didn't hear you. You said you figure pretty much everyone's always been interested in this.
I do, and I think Sarah Ruhl has been very, very successful in just bringing visibility to an area of study that, let's face it, is fascinating.
That's the truth.
Yes, it is, and she did do a very good job. It's an excellent play.
Yeah. Rachel Maines, author of the book "The Technology of Orgasm: Hysteria, the Vibrator, and Women's Sexual Satisfaction." Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Fran Prine, the director of Pygmalion Company's production of In the Next Room, or the Vibrator Play, which is based on Maine's research, runs through the May 19th at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. Go to our website for the particulars about that. Thank you very much, Fran.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.